Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, June 5th, 2010. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host. This coming Tuesday, June 8th, will mark the 200th birthday of a great figure in history, the composer and music critic Robert Schumann. Born in Zwickau, Germany, Schumann, along with his wife Clara, who was a brilliant pianist and his closest collaborator, waged an inspiring battle to not just defend and protect the great cultural heritage of classical musical composition, but to advance it. This tradition originated with the towering genius of Johann Sebastian Bach in the early to mid-18th century. It was revived and advanced by the collaboration of Wolfgang Mozart and Haydn in Vienna in the early 1780s, and developed further by Beethoven and Franz Schubert, among others. This tradition was then rescued by Felix Mendelssohn and his family, beginning with a spectacular performance of Bach's great St. Matthew Passion, a piece which Bach had written in 1727, but it hadn't been performed outside of Leipzig for over 100 years when Mendelssohn performed it in Berlin in 1829. The Schumanns, who became very close collaborators with Felix Mendelssohn in Leipzig, took up the task of restoring this great tradition in the face of a brutal assault in the name of the new music, which was run by, in particular, Franz Liszt and Richard Wagner. LaRouche Pack and the Schiller Institute are commemorating this 200th birthday of Robert Schumann by continuing this battle today. As Lyndon LaRouche emphasizes in virtually all of his writings, the creative impulse in great classical culture and in scientific discovery is the same. Those, on the other hand, who wish to destroy the advance of science, such as the followers of the evil Lord Bertrand Russell today, always deploy against artists, such as the Schumanns, to destroy classical culture. Winning this battle today is thus a life and death question for civilization. The global financial and economic collapse is the direct result of the attack on classical culture, which really is the basis of the creativity needed to solve the problems that we face globally today. So the choice really is between a new dark age or the opening of a new era of scientific discovery centered on manned exploration of space. It is fair to say that today, to get to Mars, we must first go back to Bach. Joining me on the program today to discuss this are three people who have been engaged in this battle for years. David Shaven is the author of a new study, The Musical Soul of Scientific Creativity, Rebecca de Richelet's Development of the Complex Domain, and that, I'm told, will be out in this week's issue of the Executive Intelligence Review. Joining us from Denmark today is Michelle Rasmussen, who has a fascinating article coming out, I believe, the next week in the EIR, titled Robert and Clara Schumann and Their Teacher, Johann Sebastian Bach. Okay. And also joining us today will be Michwa Steger, one of the leaders of the National Music Program of the LaRouche Youth Movement. So I'd like to welcome the three of you to this program today.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Thank you.
And I'll begin with Michwa, because you were at the center of a recent development in which we directed a successful and well-deserved shot on behalf of the Schumanns against the despicable anti-human so-called composer of music dramas, the dramas which inspired Adolf Hitler, Richard Wagner, in Los Angeles. Tell us about what you and the LaRouche Youth Movement did.
Well, I think instead of new music, it should probably have been called non-music. But the real question is that it was, I think the important part to emphasize is that this is a continuation of the mass strike mobilization that we're involved in the field. And the Wagner intervention, it was pretty hilarious. We had a huge banner that said Nazis, I forget, what did it say?
Nazis. Wagner, loved by Nazis.
Oh, Wagner loved by Nazis and rejected by humans. And it was probably an 8-foot banner that was spread out. But the interesting thing that occurred was, as soon as we had to kind of go in secretly because you had all these people that had paid maybe hundreds of dollars for a ticket to go see this fest. But we'd entered with about 30 young people from our chorus and essentially stood in the middle of the entire atrium outside where people are gathered. You know, they have their fancy dinners beforehand. And then we unfurled the banner and started singing Va Pensiero. And it was a specifically chosen piece to sing because, you know, of the significance of the freeing of the Hebrew slaves. And also, you know, Verdi as a much better proposal than Wagner. So we unfurled it, and soon they knew we were pretty much up to something because we had been mass leafleting Harley's leaflet before we got there to actually sing. But as soon as they started unfurling the banner, I had about four police officers, or I don't know what you call them. They're not really quite police officers. But four of them surrounded me, and I think we've had a lot of practice from the State Democratic Convention through now that I'm always going to be the one that's targeted because I'm kind of leading the chorus. And so they'll come after me, and the chorus essentially, I've realized that I can buy time for the chorus if I can just talk to these people, and the chorus will just continue, and the audience will kind of get involved in what they're singing. So they were singing the Va Pensiero. I'm fighting with the police officers because they're telling us that we're disturbing the peace. And the point that I had to make was, well, you think we're disturbing the peace with Va Pensiero when you have Wagner, who is a known anti-Semite, playing inside the hall? And I asked him specifically if people in the audience weren't upset and weren't coming up to me asking us to stop. So it was a good back and forth. Eventually, we moved down to a location and sang for about an hour, where the entrance to the hall and also from the parking structure was. So it was a good situation to be in. And, you know, we had just one situation with three young men. I was reported this from somebody in the chorus that they had been watching us for about 10 or 15 minutes singing. And the next thing I knew, there was a car parked next to the chorus that was blasting Wagner from the sunroof. And all their windows were open. There were three young men in the car, and I, you know, probably in their 20s. And the chorus just turned around, and we started singing Ante Froide for Beethoven and completely washed them out. So I think that was pretty striking, but one essential thing that really struck me was reports from Phil Rubenstein that he had been organizing people while he was passing out the leaflet. And he said that, you know, somebody was like, well, what's the big deal? Wagner's dead. You know, why are you still going after him? And I think that's a good paradox for people in the population to have, because the youth of the chorus, we're not going out and battling, you know, we don't want to go head-to-head with people. But because this is part of a mass strike mobilization, we have a certain responsibility to show people their identity as human beings and that this is a continuation of the fight for the identity of man. Those are some of the highlights.
And that was picked up in the Los Angeles Times, which probably for the first time in my experience ran an honest coverage by talking about what was in our leaflet. And what was in our leaflet is we just identified the fact that the Los Angeles County, which is bankrupt, was underwriting the Wagner, what we called the Ringworm Fest, these performances of three cycles of four operas, that they were using money that could have gone to pay for teachers' salaries, and instead they were promoting Wagner. And the leaflet identified the anti-human, anti-classical mentality of Wagner. And so this was something that shocked the music world. And I think besides this person who Mihua identified, who doesn't understand history, who raised this question, you had the other thing, people saying, oh, well, but Wagner, yes, he was a vile person, but his music was so beautiful. And Wagner himself said, you can't separate the art from the artist. Now, David, why don't you jump in here? Because you have in your article a really vivid description of the ongoing battle between Liszt and Wagner on the one hand and the Felix Mendelssohn, the Schumanns, and Brahms on the other.
Well, good. I'll try to encapsulate some of that. But just to make the connection with the decision in California on funding this and the evilness behind Wagner and Liszt, behind the scenes, there really is we're at a point where the poor, the weak, and the helpless will either be thrown overboard or they're going to be defended. And this is known. And then what happens to the human mind when they have to make decisions to throw the weak and helpless overboard is not a pretty sight. And that really, there's a connection. It's not just they blew X amount of money they could have given to teachers. They know that they are in a cut, slash, and burn mode, and they celebrate the ugliness and evil of Wagner. You know, it's a double sin. So just to get at, Wagner wrote an essay back in 1850. He had it published anonymously. It's called Jewishness in Music. He was, what had happened just previous to that is Robert Schumann and Felix Mendelssohn, and along with Clara Schumann and several others, were leading a revival of Bach. And Bach, for Germany at the time, met mastering the powers of the human mind, the non-visible causal powers of the human mind that will get us to Mars today. But this classical culture question of how you develop the mind, and it's not any old fantasy in the mind. It's how to lawfully develop the powers of the mind that have causal actions, the most efficient and powerful causal results, you know, in the objective world. This was the core to what they were doing. Caused a freak out among the oligarchs at the time, and the first time this appeared was while Mendelssohn was still alive. This Hegelian named Brendel issued a public attack trying to separate Schumann and Mendelssohn from each other. And it was just the basic argument. Mendelssohn, because he's so good at expressing the classics of Goethe and Schiller and Bach, therefore necessarily is of the past. And the future cannot be connected with that. And we're for the future. And Schumann should separate himself from these non-Germans who don't really understand our own peculiar background, and they have to sort of manufacture classical music. It's an artificial. So it leaves open this whole question about what the future music was going to be. But Mendelssohn dies prematurely, about age 38, in 1847, and Liszt and Wagner just start going crazy. This essay, just to give you a couple of quotes from it, which is all I can stomach, he explains about how Germany never would have allowed Jewish composers except because they're nothing different from maggots. The quote is, "So long as the separate art of music had a real organic life need in it, there was nowhere to be found a Jewish composer. Only when a body's inner death is manifest do outside elements win the power of lodgment in it, yet merely to destroy it. Then indeed that body's flesh dissolves into a swarming colony of insect life. But who in looking on that body's self would hold it still for living?" Hmm. Nice guy.
It's pretty clear.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can pick quite a few quotes from Wagner, and for those who say that these are momentary lapses, it's actually consistent in everything he did and said. And it's not just anti-Semitism. One of the points Lyndon LaRouche makes is that it's anti-human.
This is the next quote. The only other quote I'm picking is just that.
Yeah.
You can try to figure out who he's attacking more. But he claims that the work he wrote, Jewishness in Music, was written, quote, "to explain to ourselves the involuntary repellence possessed for us by the nature and personality of the Jews, so as to vindicate that instinctive dislike which we plainly recognize as stronger and more overpowering than our conscious zeal to rid ourselves hereof." That is one sentence.
Yeah.
And aside from the attacks on the Jews, what's really going on here? We Germans have this instinctive dislike, and I'm writing this thing because we have to vindicate that instinctive dislike that we all feel, that involuntary repellence. because we plainly recognize that's stronger than all this conscious zeal we've had to try to rid ourselves of that. And that's the last point. The conscious zeal, that's what new music is. It means Bach, Goethe, Schiller, everything that's made the height of Germany be a hope for all humanity is the conscious zeal to deal with this inner beast. And we should not do that. We should actually let the inner beast come out. Everything we've done along the line. So new music just means one thing. It means get rid of Bach. Mendelssohn was a jerk to ever try to bring Bach back to us Germans. So I think that's
now,
the basic outline.
I'd like to bring Michelle in here to give us a little bit on the connection between the Schumanns and Bach. This is really at the heart of her article. This question of how Bach was the teacher of the Schumanns and Clara Wieck Schumann. So, Michelle, what was it in Bach that the Schumanns found essential for musical composition?
Well, it was both a question of what they found in Bach, but also the question of how to learn to compose. Because Robert Schumann, where he had just some basic musical training when he was young. Then when he was around 20 years old, he started taking composition lessons with the director of the Leipzig Opera. And then after some months, he quit, and he wrote to his teacher that he simply, his entire being is rebelling against every external influence. And I have to discover things on my own for the first time in order to assimilate them and put them in their proper place. And this is what Lynn LaRouche has always stressed when it comes to music, when it comes to science, that in order to learn to be creative, the thing is to pretty much throw out the textbooks and go back to try to relive the very discoveries of the most creative people in either art or science. And Robert Schumann was extremely conscious of this, and what he did was he simply took Bach's fugues, and especially his fugues from the two volumes of the Well-Tempered Clavier, and he studied them for several hours a day. And what he got from Bach is the special genius of Bach and the special idea of counterpoint, of which Bach was the utmost master. Mm-hmm. This means that you write music based on not one voice, not like a pop music tune, which has a melody and then some chords or umpah, but each of the voices, you write music which has several voices, and they are in continual dialogue with each other. Each voice is beautiful and challenging in and of itself, but is designed to be in dialogue with the other voices and reacts to the other voices as you have on a Shakespeare drama, where what one voice does, what one character does, affects what the other ones are doing. And they come into conflict, which is called dissonance in music. And this is what Robert Schumann wanted to learn, how to write in this contrapuntal way. And also, when he got married, the first thing that he and Clara did in 1840, when they got married, was they simply studied these fugues of Bach together as a way of deepening Clara's insight into music. Here she was, as you said, she was one of the most foremost, she was the most foremost pianist in Europe of her time. And she had always composed music and improvised at the piano every day. but being able to get into the what is behind the notes, not just playing the notes, not just having a kind of instinct for what is happening in the music, but a very conscious idea through the eyes of her husband, Robert the composer, of how Bach had composed these, so that they, both Robert and Clara, could use these ideas as in any Renaissance. They were conscious of the fact that if they were going to make breakthroughs of creating a real new music, that they would have to master the principles behind which Bach used to create his music.
Michelle, let me just ask you, for the sake of our listeners who may not be familiar with some of the music of Robert Schumann, if you could recommend a couple pieces. I know you do this in your article, where you see the direct study, the piece as a direct study or outcome of the study that Schumann did of Bach.
Well, one of the most special ones, which is a piece of music which is not even known today, is a piece of music that was originally written for something called a pedal piano. That is a piano with a kind of mechanical foot pedal, so that you could have more than two hands. You could also have your feet as you do with an organ. But this is, I think it's Opus 60, but he wrote a series of theme and variations over the name of Bach, because B-A-C-H, in Europe, B is the American B-flat, mm-hmm. and H is the American B. So in other words, B-A-C-H is something like la, 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 la. So it's actually music. And Robert Schumann, he goes through and he writes lots of variations, but you can see in his own tonal language, he writes lots of variations over this theme in all kind of creative ways.
And that goes directly back to Bach, because he closed the musical offering with playing with that theme.
Yeah, Art of the Few.
That's
The Art of the Few.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And actually, it was at the last part, which people think was to be a four-subject fugue. The third subject is his own name. And then after a few measures, he stopped writing it. And that's actually a controversy, because his son wrote in there afterwards, well, after he wrote this, he died. But then it came out that he actually didn't die for like another 6 months. So it's a question mark. But anyway, that's one piece. The other piece that I go through a little bit in the article is the Andante Espressivo section of the Second Symphony. But even in an earlier period, if you look at Robert Schumann's great song cycles, in the year 1840, the Dichte Liebe, Frauen lieben und leben, these are also where the piano is playing a very essential role, and not just accompanying.
Well, I was going to ask Mihua, because you're preparing for a series of Schumann Fests, and you're a pianist and also a singer and a conductor, and you've been looking now at the Schumann accompaniment, and they're really not accompaniment. They're almost, the piano is another, in some cases, one voice, in some cases, more than one voice, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's at times you're actually, you know, if you have two singers, then the pianist is another voice, and within that voice you always have, you know, actually multiple voices in terms of polyphony. But it is a challenging aspect, because the assumption in society is that, oh, you know, it's just kind of an accompaniment. The main people participating are the ones that are singing. but that people don't think of it from the standpoint of a collaboration from the highest level, that it is another voice interacting with these other voices to create a certain conversational polyphony that communicates the idea of what I addressed before as, you know, the identity of a human being, of a creative aspect.
Well, and you had a similar work that you were doing that you and I actually have worked on for years, looking at the well-tempered clavier to the same way Mozart did, the same way Schumann did, to see how there are more than one voice or two voices in a piano piece.
Absolutely, yeah. I've always been struck with Bach, particularly because he is, especially through the preludes and fugues, that they are so dense. And I've not found, you know, you have these compositions or composers like Mozart and Beethoven that have built upon their relationship to Bach, but that Bach's density and his rate of action in terms of his fugues of, you know, 1 minute you're in one place and the next second you could just be in a completely different domain, that he really mastered. He had a mastery of the human mind and the science of the human mind and was able to communicate that through his compositions and art.
You're listening to The LaRouche Show. We're having a roundtable discussion of the importance of commemorating the 200th anniversary of the birth of Robert Schumann, which will take place officially on June 8th of this year in a couple of days. David, there's a question from the LaRouche Youth Movement in Berlin, Daniel Gressenakanta, who asked, he obviously read your article, and he was discussing the importance that you put on the defense of Bach by Mendelssohn, Schumann, and Brahms. And he said, why was this defense of Bach necessary, and what did it mean? I presume that he's asking, who was it that it was attacking Bach, and why?
Well, on one level, quite generally, you had the Congress of Vienna in 1815, which is sort of the reaction against the American Revolution and the possibilities of human development. So you have, it affected culture across the board. So over the years, you had more unmoored music. You had what we call, what they will now label as Romanticism, which is just getting away from actually having to think when you're playing.
Yeah.
You know, so it's that's what Bach was. So quite generally, it's just, I don't want to think. You know, and more specifically, you know, that Brendel attack was one of the more nasty ones when Mendelssohn revived Bach. But as you mentioned at the opening, the 1829 first volley in that brawl to revive Bach was the St. Matthew's Passion, which had not been performed in 100 years. And this is sort of a controversial question. Bach was never totally forgotten. People who had to be competent, they went to learn their Bach, their well-tempered clavier. This was the Bible of learning how to do music. But the more music got away from producing musical scientists, you everything else comes in there by process of elimination without anybody else trying to even attack Bach. You just let things, you know, float. So I don't think anybody really would. I may be way off target on this thing, but I don't think there were a whole lot of direct attacks. They were just running away from doing the work.
Well, I think the other point is that in this discussion of Romanticism, I'd like to throw this out to the three of you. One of the things that's often said is that I believe if you read some of the historiography, that somewhere on an evening in 1817, Beethoven became a romantic, and all the classical tradition died, and Romanticism was now in vogue. And in fact, what Wagner builds on is this idea explicitly in his writings. He talks about emotion rather than critical thinking. So what is the issue here? Michelle, why don't you lay to rest this idea that Schumann was a quote-unquote romantic composer?
Well, the question of Romanticism is not that it creates a romantic feeling, for example, what you might think on the surface. But the issue is, why do you write music and why do you perform music? Do you write music and do you perform music to show off how fast you can play? For example, if you ever hear a Liszt transcription of something by Bach or somebody else, it's just like adding 50 million extra superfluous notes in order to show off that, you know, that you might think that five people are playing the piano when it's only one. Actually, Clara Schumann at one point said that the more she is away from the concert scene, the more she has abhorrence for people who play just based on showing off their virtuosity. And this is actually one of the problems that we have of young musicians today, because we have a lot of young musicians, and this is not just something that we say in the Schiller Institute, but it's known that we have a lot of young musicians who are technically more precise. They don't make mistakes. They can play faster. But the inner drive for what it is that you write music for and what you play music for, it's really the question of the most joyful way of expressing the creativity of the human mind itself. The joyous nature of the human mind to be playful and to counterpose ideas and to create, for example, a theme and variations, where you take just a simple theme and then, like a Beethoven or any of these great composers, can just be so creative. And it's in the music, it is able, when it's played and written for eternity, as, for example, Robert Schumann explicitly said in one of the letters he wrote. He says he goes back to Bach because his works seem written for eternity. And this is the purpose of music, of writing it and of performing it. It is to move your audience in a way that nothing else that is created by human beings can. And that's the difference between, you know, what we're saying is the difference between Romanticism and the classical, classicism. The classical is to look in the deepest ways that the composers look in the deepest wells of their creative soul. And as, for example, Beethoven would always say, you know, he was deaf. He did not have an easy life, but as he said in this critical point in his life, he said, I cannot end my life now because I know that there is so much in me that has to come out. Robert Schumann had it at the end of his life. He knew he was actually going crazy. He had mental health problems, and he did actually end his days in a mental institution. But he fought on, and in fact, he at every point, also when he was faced with his own mental stress, he went back to Bach to be refreshed by the creativity of the human soul. And that's what we have to, as musicians and as music lovers, have to expect.
David, I'd like you to jump in here now with the theme of your article, because you write about the relationship between the musical circles of the Mendelssohn family and the Schumanns and the scientific circles that go back to the Gauss, de Richelieu, Riemann. In fact, the marriage of the younger sister of Felix Mendelssohn, Rebecca, to de Richelieu. You tell a delightful story about how they first got together with the work going on in Berlin on the St. Matthew Passion. I wonder if you could just tell that story and then give a little bit of a sense of building on what Michelle just said about the relationship between science and music.
Okay, let me try to do that in three points. One, the second will be that story. I mean, one way to say what classical is human beings are different from every other species, and we have a direct relationship with our maker, with our creator. And classical and non-classical music denies that. Classical structures in music are based upon the lawful proportionalities, the most central one being what's called the golden mean, but you can express it as God would compose in the universe in such a way that what he makes reflects the process of the creation. I won't get into a whole math lesson here, but the whole to the part, to the greater part, is the same as the greater part to the smaller part. So you make a division, an action, so that the relationship between the produced parts reflects the act of creation of the creator to the created. And, you know, so when we say science, classical music and science has a connection, it's not just we'd like to have it, to have a connection. It has the connection. In the garden, Alexander Humboldt had brought the young, talented Dirichlet into Berlin in 1828. It was at that time, I think Felix Mendelssohn is 19, 18. He's
about 19.
Yeah, he's about 19 then. And they have a project. His mother's side of the family came from the Itzigs, and they had passed down text of Bach, and they had made a big deal of preserving, probably was the central force in preserving Bach's manuscripts. And his Aunt Sarah, I forget which one it was.
It was his Aunt Sarah.
Was that it? Gave Felix the manuscript for the St. Matthew's Passion. And Mendelssohn and a friend of his, Devrient, an actor, they would organize to put on this St. Matthew's Passion. It took a good part of a year. It was performed in March of 1829. But it was being rehearsed throughout 1828 at the Mendelssohn household. They had a garden in the back with a garden house, and they, generally speaking, that's where they were doing the rehearsing. And Alexander Humboldt, along with Gauss, had arranged with Abraham Mendelssohn, the father of Felix and Fanny and Rebecca and Paul, the four children, to build a specially constructed hut in the backyard to do magnetic measurements of the geomagnetism of the earth, which means a hut. You have to build it without any nails and any iron, et cetera. So Dirichlet is one of the fellows back there in the Mendelssohn backyard as they're doing these measurements of the earth's geomagnetic properties and mappings of this thing as they're doing these rehearsals. Originally, it was like 10 to 20 of their good friends. It ended up, in the last month or two, these core of 10 or 20 singers had to be teaching and be the core in the different soprano, alto, tenor, bass sections.
Sort of like a Mönch Brigade for the LaRouche Youth Movement today.
Exactly. What ended up being 300 or 400 people coming in to sing. So and the last part, just on Dirichlet. Rebecca, the younger sister, was four different fellows were trying to marry her, trying to get her attention. The winner was Lejeune Dirichlet. But Heine was one of the ones. He lost out, I think. Evidently, he wrote a note to Rebecca saying that he misses her greatly, and that every ounce of her of chubby Rebecca is an angel. Which somehow that didn't work. Another one was Droysen, a famous classicist, who wrote a very young, brilliant 19-year-old man who, within the next few years, just stunned the field of Greek scholarship. He wrote a famous Alexander the Great biography. We won't skip it. So the Dirichlet and his wife Rebecca are in Berlin for throughout the 1830s, 1840s. In 1855, right after Gauss passes away, Dirichlet is called to go to Göttingen to succeed Gauss as the head of the mathematics department. The one thing really to central, just to say it too quickly, but about Dirichlet's mathematics is he does rigorous analysis without using numbers. And it just freaks out all the mathematicians that you're actually doing rigorous analysis. More causality is being captured without having to dip down to just making the numbers do the work for you. And what Riemann learns from this in terms of this hypergeometric series is abelian functions. This is what's being discussed up at Göttingen in 1855, 1856, 1857. Rebecca up in Göttingen decides to open up some music ovens like her older sister Fanny had done in Berlin over many years. And it takes a little bit of courage. And lo and behold, immediately Clara Schumann comes to play. And she plays this famous Bach piece, the Chromatic Fantasy and Fugue, which I think Miwas vowed to produce the final work on that, right?
Yes, I think.
Yeah,
that's
I said
now
it was a lifelong vow.
Okay. Well, I'll hang around a long time to see that. And so Clara picks a number of pieces, but that's the key one. I don't think I should go into all that story right now.
Well, but I think the important thing in your article is that you then see that a consistent pattern of the interaction of people who are the great scientists, the great musicians, the discussion, and this process continues through Max Planck and Einstein.
Sure. Clara Schumann, then Johannes Brahms, and his friend Joseph Joachim come in the first few months to present critical works. You'd like to be a fly on the wall, but you can be rest assured, Dirichlet, Riemann, and others, just like LaRouche reported in his work on Riemann in the early 1950s, said when you're doing this type of work, the only proper type of recreation to replenish your mind, LaRouche reported on the role of the late Beethoven quartets, but you want to have something going on where you're singing and celebrating the type of processes in your mind without having to, as it were, bring yourself down below earth, you know, to just rocks and things. And
this was
absolutely critical for the cultural life to allow scientists to push the frontiers of mathematics and science where they did. I'll just throw out one last thing. 1729 was the St. Matthew's Passion. It was also the birth of Moses Mendelssohn and his friend Lessing that year.
Right.
So Felix Mendelssohn, when he was deciding to revive this in 1829, they were seeing this coming up as a proper way to revive German culture of Moses Mendelssohn and Lessing. And at some point, we're going to have to tell the story about how Einstein played his violin in Berlin at the 1929 celebrations of Mendelssohn and Moses Mendelssohn and Lessing.
I think you just did.
Well, there's more to be told, but yeah, I'll throw that out there.
Well, and I think, David, today this is the reason that I initiated a project around the 200th birthday of Robert Schumann. I spoke with Lyndon LaRouche, and I said this is an opportunity now to bring together, in a sense, the two arcs, both in the scientific and in the cultural realm, that go back really to Leibniz in Germany and the fight at the Academy of Friedrich the Great, of the Moses Mendelssohn and Lessing defending Leibniz. At the same time, the Bach tradition was being attacked but also advanced. And so in a sense, by commemorating this birthday, we're looking back over this incredibly rich period of contrapuntal development in all areas of human creative activity, the sciences, music, statecraft even, because it's also interesting you find Bismarck in this whole process, huh? So
right.
I think this is the benefit we can have from the commemoration of this birthday.
I'm not sure what you're leading to on Bismarck, but the story of the Mendelssohn family is best written by Fanny Mendelssohn Hensel's son, Sebastian Hensel, yes, named after Bach, her favorite, who, when he's writing this work in the late 1860s, he's reflecting on, he talks about the role of Moses Mendelssohn as a young man coming from a ghetto in Dessau, moving to a Jewish ghetto in Berlin, and comparing it to the situation with the fight for the cultural life of the slaves of the United States that had just been freed, he says, by Lincoln a few years earlier. This is 1869 when he's saying this.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's got this, I forget exactly how it goes, but it's a very optimistic statement referring to Bismarck and the nationalization of Germany, that no longer does Germany have to develop in a bizarre
way where we're pushing ahead culturally and backwards politically, that now Europe, the wounds of Europe can be dealt with. This is at the very end of his book, the very end of two volumes, the last couple of pages, where he actually sort of tips his hand on his hopes for Germany in terms of why he's writing the story of the Mendelssohn family, because of the new hope for Europe that Germany
can be a
united nation.
The youngest daughter of Clara and Robert, Eugenie, in her book, The Schumanns and Johannes Brahms, writes of the great patriotic fever that Clara Schumann had, who Clara Schumann's childhood friend through her whole life was Emily List, the daughter of Friedrich List, the American system economist, who had moved to Leipzig and got to know the Wieck family there, Clara's family there. And Friedrich List was the person who came up with the original plan to break down the division of the states in Germany through a customs union. Also, just one other little tidbit on this was that Brahms, by the way, was a great admirer of Bismarck, but Brahms, Joachim, and Clara Schumann were at Musikabends in Berlin in the 1870s, where one of the participants was General von Moltke, who was the leader of the Prussian armies that won the battle against the French in 1870-71 that unified Germany, and then was assigned by Bismarck to build the railway system. And Eugenie writes, how disappointed we were when General von Moltke told us that Bismarck would not be attending our music because he was too shy.
Yeah. That's great.
So you have the political and those networks. And I'd like to ask Michelle, because you have a beautiful story about the Schumanns and a telescope, I think is appropriate here.
Oh, yes.
Okay. Yes, it's because it's the way that I actually end up the article, and it's appropriate to the title of your title for the show. What do you call our show today, Harley?
Oh, you mean the idea of the road to Mars is through Bach?
Right. I'll just read it to you. Epilogue. Schumann and Mendelssohn were speaking together about a recently invented telescope. Schumann reported, when I told him about the great telescope, referring to Mendelssohn, when I told him about the great telescope and about a remark I read somewhere that to the inhabitants of distant planets, we would appear when viewed through the telescope somewhat like mites on a piece of cheese. Mendelssohn said, yes, but the well-tempered clavier would still inspire them with respect. and so I say, maybe if the spacecraft named actually Kepler, which is out there now searching for planets like Earth, if they discover life out there in the great universe, maybe Kepler will find that they are playing Bach.
Well, I think the one of the questions, we're down to about the last 12 minutes, and we are talking about winning this fight today, and Mihwa, you are out organizing quite a bit of time. You're organizing young people. One of the points Lyndon LaRouche has been making is that this classical culture that we're discussing has been denied most people in the youth generation. It was there to some extent for us boomers, but we made a mess out of it. But it's almost gone. And Mihwa, what do you find when we're out singing, when we sing on campuses, when we sing at Democratic Party conventions, or out in front of the quasi-Nazi spectacle of the Wagner ringworm cycle in Los Angeles? How does classical music still reach people in spite of this decay of culture?
Well, I think what I'd like to emphasize is, you know, through the discussion that we've had over the last 45 minutes, is the necessity to really win the fight against the British. Because what I encounter, I mean, out in the field here, but I have a sense nationally of what we also encounter, is that the idea of classical for me, and also what we're involved in terms of the Monge Brigades here and the chorus, is that you're actually fighting for those ideas and principles which advanced human society and thought through an arc of history, you know, in a sense, the arc of creative history. And so when we go out into the street or onto the campuses, we encounter young people. And I've seen, even within the past 5 years, a drastic disintegration of the culture and the state of minds of the youth. And it's a particular attack on the creative aspect, which is what the British Empire goes after, because they know that if they can subjugate a nation to, you know, this cult of money or, you know, the cult of opinion, that you can really hold them as slaves and enslave their minds, which is the worst form of crime. So, you know, the singing really gets people, especially the young people that are on their campuses and plugged into their iPods or phones or whatever. They have plugs everywhere. Out of that situation, and it actually elevates their mind to even have the capacity and capability to have a discussion with you because they're completely intrigued. And the role that our chorus and the music plays out in the field is to touch that part of their spirit that still exists, which is human. And eventually, you know, it'll provoke them to begin asking questions and kind of clear away all the cobwebs and the crap that's been thrown at them through their school and society. I mean, it's true. If you think about the work that people do today, it's not real work. So when Lin was doing real work, he needed a recreation that continued to feed those aspects of his mind that were really at work. And today you have people worried about whether they're going to make it through the next day or through the next week. And then the music that we have in society directly reflects that.
Now, Michelle, let me ask you, because I know in Europe there... The Europeans, of course, look down their noses at the colonies and at the Americas, and yet it seems to me that from what I can tell of the Schumann celebrations this year, and there are quite a few of them, but they're still more of a museum piece than actually the kind of living culture that you write about that existed between Robert and Clara and their collaborators. I wonder if you could comment on that.
Well, I'm actually not sure that that's the case, because for example, tomorrow, I think it's the European Radio Cooperation System, they're actually having 10 hours of Schumann on the radio with contributions from all different European countries and including the United States. And the celebration in Zwickau, which is the birthplace of Robert Schumann, is going to be very special, and it's actually a concert with Daniel Barenboim, who is the conductor. And the thing that is really special about it is that it's actually going to be held in a park free for anybody to come to. And every year they also, even when it's not the 200th birthday, the town of Zwickau actually celebrates the birth of Robert Schumann with a special ceremony at the statue of Schumann in the town. Here in Copenhagen and in Denmark, there's going to be a special concert. The radio is going to have a transmission from, I think, the Turnhalle in Austria, and on Friday night there's going to be a very big concert with both Lieder and instrumental works and symphonies.
So perhaps the revival of this kind of culture can go along with the development of the courage to break with the euro and have the kind of national development that the Schumanns and Brahms were looking for Germany at the turn of the century.
I just wanted to say one more thing before we close out the show, which is
sure.
that your wife, who unfortunately died a year ago, Susan Schlanger, was a great admirer of Robert Schumann, and really really held the works of Robert Schumann dear to her heart. And I think that it would be important to mention that in this program about Schumann and the commemoration of Schumann, how dear she held that, and what a great example she was also in the last part of her life when she was fighting both cancer and to continue to raise the funds and to be a political leader. And I actually dedicated my article to her, because the first draft that I had written, even though I had been collecting material as far back as 10 years ago, was for the Festschrift for her birthday, just a couple months before she died.
Yes, well, thank you for bringing that up. And we are going to have a Schumann commemoration in the form of a Schumann contra Wagner in Los Angeles sometime end of July, early August. People can just check on LaRouche PAC website or with your contacts in the LaRouche movement for information on it, in which we're going to have a two-day conference. Mihwa will play a leading role in that. We hope to have David and Nancy Shaven out in Los Angeles for it.
Yeah.
I guess you just made that happen, huh?
Well, yeah, I guess so.
And we're going to use it to follow up the excitement, because, look, our intervention here against Wagner excited people, because most people, you know, the old story of opera in the United States is people go to be seen and to try out their new fur coat. And in Los Angeles in the summer, to wear a fur coat, it's kind of difficult. But, David, we just have a couple minutes left. If you can just put kind of a cap on this, on the importance of this kind of culture versus Wagner.
Yeah, this beauty is great any time, but we're in a dangerous period where to allow ugly things to go on unchallenged destroys not just physical bodies, it destroys the human mind and the human spirit. I was trying to get at that on this matter, this ugly decision of the county to throw $13-14 million from a bankrupt county.
Yeah.
This is just gratuitous nonsense. It's courageous to actually have your back up against the wall and spend precious resources on something that's going to fight you your way out of the mess. But this is simply a celebration of evil. These are people who've decided to give up their love and concern for humanity. So this is a lawful, you can call it unlawful, but it's lawful that this type of fascism arises in this period. And it's going to take great courage. It's going to take the humor of Heinrich Heine, which, I mean, what I remember about you, Susan's love of Schumann, maybe more broad than what I know, but I know it was his settings of Heine.
Yeah.
And it's going to take this outrageous love for humanity, and we can beat these assholes. You know, that's what classical culture is. I'll give you one. If I have time, I'll give you one quote from Joachim, for after years of having Franz Liszt, you know, try to recruit him. He finally confronts the guy and says, writes him a letter and says, "Your music is entirely antagonistic to me. It contradicts everything with which the spirits of our great ones have nourished my mind from my earliest youth. If it were thinkable that I could ever be deprived of, that I should ever have to renounce all that I learnt to love and honor in their creations, all that I feel music to be, your strains would not fill one corner of the vast waste of nothingness. I must rather make up my mind to strive for that which I have marked out for myself, for that which I know to be good, and which I consider to be my mission."
And let me just add that was the same mission that Clara Schumann had in her open and very strong attacks on Wagner. When other people were afraid to do it, she courageously stood forward and said, "Your music is the most disgusting thing known to me." Well, we've come to the end of the program.
Can I just add one sentence?
Go ahead.
Yeah, just that I think that from this program that we should also send a message to the citizens of Israel because after this atrocity last week with the ship, that really to look back and to look at the kind of humanism of Moses Mendelssohn and of this tradition that we've been speaking about, and really changed that policy.
Changed that culture. Well, you know, in Israel, it used to be illegal to perform Wagner, and they dropped that law. So in any case, we're out of time. Michelle, thank you. David, Mihwa. And we're going to continue this fight. So look on the LaRouche PAC website, and then in LaRouchePub.com, David's article is coming out this week and Michelle's next week. So thank you, and join us again next Saturday at 3 p.m. Eastern for the next edition of the LaRouche Show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.